Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. Each fortnight on Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will Dracula make an appearance? In this episode, actor and writer Tim Downey will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Downey has starred in Upstart Crow, Toast of London, Hapless, Outlander. He's in a billion things in 2022, and he's the chair of the committee that decides which animals pedestrian crossings will be named after. Tim Downey, welcome to Greenlit.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. It's a real thrill. Finally, my life will be made into a movie. It's been in the making now for 40-odd years, so very excited we've got here.
I'm so pleased to be able to give you the good news and to be part of the process. Like you say, long time coming. Would you say your life has been in development hell if it's been this long for the biopic to be?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of setbacks, mainly financial. a lot of backers pulling out, which was a mistake at the time. But we're here. But look at the positives, you know. We're ready, let's start shooting.
Well, I'm really glad that you have kept up your enthusiasm for this project, because it could have been so easy to lose heart after all these setbacks.
You soldier on, and you keep making memories. Toby, you keep making memories. And that's the main thing.
That is such an incredibly actory thing to say. Like, I just imagine that, like, the last day of drama school going, and remember, guys, just keep making memories.
Absolutely. As the glitter bomb comes off, everyone's giving jazz hands, and then it's all down to the telemarketing research center.
No, but that's research, though, Tim. That's research.
Vital research. As you'll see, I've spent many an interesting hour as an early actor in a telemarketing research center.
So before we get started on the film, before we start shooting, we need to know, is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
I go biopic.
Biopic.
A biographical picture. Biopic.
Biopic.
I think it gives you everything you need in a sort of like a handy bite-sized portion. It's like sci-fi. You kind of know, it sounds better than science fiction. Science fiction sounds okay, a bit labored and a bit kind of dusty, but sci-fi, because it sounds a bit like Wi-Fi or hi-fi. You know, it's got that sort of, okay, well, this is all very modern. It's one of those kind of genres as well that is so, there's much maligned. People kind of go, oh, sci-fi, thinking spaceships, aliens, zap gun, things like that. But some of the sort of greatest works of literature, in my view, fall under that, that titling, as in things like by J.G. Ballard or Philip K. Dick, truly great kind of philosophical works that fall under sci-fi and are not sort of, space cowboys and things like that. It doesn't have to be.
No, particularly both of the people there you mentioned, there's a real miserabilist nature to their work. Like the future isn't exciting. The future isn't a happy place. It's the same as it is now, if not slightly unhappier, because it should be better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Ballard's early stuff was all about environmental disasters, drowned world, the drought, things like that. You kind of think, wow, okay, this is all going to end up quite well. His later works being things like, Crash and the Atrocity Exhibition. Okay, all right, I'm sensing a theme, Jim. I'm sensing a theme. But then, Philip K. Dick as well wrote some really brilliant short stories. Mm. Some of it, I mean, obviously some of which have been made in like Total Recall and stuff like that. But I remember one which is really good called The Father Thing. And I know we're kind of digressing a bit here. Just set in like a mid-American town. Father, son, and the mother just sitting down for dinner. There's a noise outside, and the dad goes out to see what's going on, and they just carry on having dinner. Father comes back in and sits down, and the kid looks at him and says, "That's not my dad. That you are not my dad." "What do you mean? I've just literally come in straight back out." And then the story is trying to find what this thing has happened. I think that's just such a beautiful kind of subtle piece of sci-fi, of this kid trying to work out, knowing that something is wrong, but people not believing him, that something has happened, something odd, something otherworldly, and that the thing in front of you is not your dad.
I've not read that. I've not read that one.
Really good. Look it up.
I will. Really good. I'm assuming they haven't made a film of it, because that would be a brilliant film.
No, but I think it's like the start of a precursor of an alien invasion or something like that. There's a grand kind of thing that happens at the end, but literally you don't really, that's not the point. That's not the point of it. The point is this little, tiny, little, kind of those little earthquakes that make it really interesting.
I'm going to speak to the studio. We're going to have to look at that as well, Tim. And you might have to play, I'm assuming, the child. You'll play the child.
I will play the child.
But for your biopic, Tim, the meeting with the executives, is it going to be in an office? Is it going to be in a restaurant? Where are you going to have that meeting? At the studio, somewhere neutral?
I would like to have the meeting. I think, you know, it's kind of in keeping. Maybe in like some sort of like disused warehouse. Just something that kind of makes them a little bit sort of uneasy. I think that's always quite a good place to put execs in. Just make them slightly uneasy and say, like, what are we doing here? And make it with a slight edge of mystery. I think that can only be a good thing. You know, so it always becomes like almost like a performance piece. You know, the whole thing becomes they're not comfortable. I'm not comfortable. I'm nervous. So I think, you know, some sort of disused warehouse or sort of farmer's barn.
Farmer's barn. See, if you had a meeting in a place such as a disused warehouse, I'm assuming there would be ominous scraping noises, slow sort of scratching sounds, metal on metal.
I think there would definitely be echoes of that. But I think it would be almost like the warehouse in Reservoir Dogs, where you've got lots of things covered. And you kind of go, what is that? That's nothing. Ignore that. What? That, no, ignore that. That kind of thing. And maybe a door just opens. You go, that's just a breeze.
Yeah. If it's like a container, like a shipping container, and the lock's padlocked, and every now and again the doors will go clunk clunk, and there'll be the padlock will rustle in the chains. What's that? No, don't. It's nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Is it still locked? Nothing to worry about. It's fine.
Well, I hope it's still locked. Did you lock it? I didn't lock it. Oh, I see.
Well, exciting news, Tim. Your life has been greenlit for biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So, Tim Downey, it's a big first question. Mm. What's the film called?
I did actually think quite long and hard about this. And I think, you know, you kind of throw words around and names around, you kind of think, oh, I shouldn't be called that. I could call it this. That sounds good, but bears no relation to my life whatsoever. So, but I have settled on this, and I think it's good. So I'd like to call it Tadpole.
Go on.
I think it's good. It's that kind of, I love films that kind of have one word that you kind of go, I have no idea what that means. I don't know how on earth that's going to bear any relation to what I'm about to see. That kind of those one word titles that are kind of slightly strange. And I thought, well, Tadpole is good because it's got a lot of kind of, you know, everyone knows what a tadpole is. And I think basically this film will be about transformation. So from a tad, and I think there's no sort of more extraordinary transformation in the natural world than a tadpole into a frog. Because, you know, it starts off almost like looking like a fish, and then it ends up with legs and living on. I mean, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary thing that nature does. But also it changes environment as well. And a lot of this story is exactly that change of environment. I grew up in the country. I then end up in the city. You're constantly shifting and changing. The film is called Tadpole. There we go.
This is a remarkable, remarkable title, and the way in which you're clearly using this example in nature to reflect your own transformation, Tim. Do you then feel an affinity with tadpoles? Are you the handsome frog now?
Well, I think I'm going to have to. Oh, okay, fine, I'll do it. I think it would also, it's the thing that a lot of us remember from school, like either there would be tadpoles in a class, like someone would show you what a tadpole looks like. So there's that harking back to childhood as well, that one of the first kind of things that you kind of see of nature, and you kind of go, oh, well, we'll put this in a tank in the classroom, and you can then watch them kind of wriggle around, and they kind of, you know, obviously grow and become what they become. There is the other thing as well, as the older you get, you may actually have to end up doing frog dissection. So it's multi-layered, this, you see. There's a lot involved, just the humble tadpole. I mean, that's probably just a movie in itself.
Did you have a pond as a child, and did you collect tadpoles from and frog spawn from that pond?
We did. We actually had, because I grew up in the country, so it was a country school, and we had, at the time, a kind of school pond, which was outside one of our classroom windows. And the one thing I really vividly remember was not necessarily the frogs this time, was when it was winter and it would get very, very cold and the whole little pond would freeze up, And it was up to then the older kids, by older kids, I mean, you know, kids under 10, to go out and crack the ice on the pond. So I remember this one particular time that was going on. The older kids went out cracking the ice. This one poor girl had a fork and was cracking the ice, and it went thunk, straight through her foot. Yeah, straight through her foot into frozen ground.
Oh!
So then to try and then pull it out with the screams and the and there was also chickens then running around as well that obviously sent the bloodletting. But yeah, that's quite a vivid memory of that. We didn't crack the ice after that.
Do you remember the poor girl's name?
Her name's Helen.
Did she return to school? What happened to her? Did she?
She did come back. Obviously, this was in the sort of early mid 80s. So it was very much sort of like, well, we're sorry we've caused so much fuss to your school, rather than you should have been looking. Why were you not looking after the children? Why were you sending them out with forks and shovels to crack ice off a pond? But, you know, them's the good old days, Toby.
That is such an incredibly chaotic scene, because not only have you got children screaming, there are chickens going berserk around her feet at the same time, and she cannot remove her foot from the earth.
I mean, it's very folk horror. Very, like, wow, okay. Obviously, I didn't see this, but you get that sense of sort of like the blood running out of her foot onto the ice and dispersing. Horrible.
You say it's a strong memory, Tim. That's not really surprising, is it? That is a strong memory, because that is quite not an extraordinary really. Thing to witness as a child.
Yeah, it was quite something. And you don't quite kind of put those bits together till kind of much later and go, that did happen, didn't it? When she put the thing and it went through her, and she couldn't get it out. I remember that now. It was strange. But it's also one of the things that kind of comes back in flashes where you know, someone will take a garden fork and go, I'm just going to go, easy with that. And I become that dad that goes, let me tell you a story about the dangers of forks.
Did you, not to dwell on this for much longer, but I am curious to know, is when you went home that day and your parents said to you, oh, how was your day at school? Did you say, yeah, nothing happened? Was it just like, you know how kids go,
almost done. Yeah, fine. Oh, there was, no, it's fine. That was probably it. That's what my kids do. That's probably exactly what I did.
Yeah, well, I suppose the fire service had to pull a fork out of Helen's foot that had become embedded in frozen. I suppose that happened.
Yeah.
But like,
Terry took a bogey out of his nose. And then he threw it and it stuck to the wall. That would probably be the memory, the most residing memory of that day at that time for an eight-year-old.
And you mentioned there in the brilliantly descriptive reason of why Tadpole would be the name. There's lots to unpick, I think, out of that, because I like you enjoy it when a film has a title which you can't quite discern what that relation might be to the film or to the character, or I'm thinking Lady Bird, I was trying to think of an animal, like a Lady Bird kind of thing.
I remember being wonderfully surprised with Knives Out, which I thought was really, really good. And one of those ones I had no idea what it was about. I'd heard someone mention it, say it was really, really good. And my wife loves those kind of slightly Agatha Christie murder mystery things. So I thought it was going to be a bit sort of, it might be a bit sort of middle of the road, but it might be fun. And then being totally kind of like, this is really well done. It's really witty and fast and really brilliantly done. So that was a lovely surprise.
Also, and you mentioned as well in the setup as to why, that kind of, like you say, all the parallels between your life and that of a tadpole. You talk about the frog, like, you maybe later in your life, and I don't know if there's a kind of a parallel to be drawn in your own life, but the frog dissection that you did at school in biology, how were you with that? Were you any good at it? Did you enjoy it?
I was all right. I think joy is quite strong when you're kind of cutting up a frog, but I've never been that squeamish. I don't mind sort of like the macabre or anything else like that. I've always been quite intrigued by it. So I was always quite sort of like, okay, well, this has to be, I'll tell you one of the, actually not, this isn't relating to frogs, but this is another memory I have when I was at school, and it was a similar sort of biology lesson. And my science teacher brought in some sheep's lungs.
Oh.
And she stuck a pipe a perspex pipe down the windpipe and then said, who would like to, this is how your lungs work. So who would like to come up and blow through the pipe to inflate the sheep's lungs? Who do you think said, yeah, I'll do that?
I think it was old Tadpole over here.
It was. Yes, it was. Absolutely extraordinary. One of the oddest things you'll ever likely to see is, you know, an 11-year-old, as I was then, blowing up a pair of sheep's lungs in on a Wednesday.
What was it like? Could you describe the sensation?
It's very.
Did you
feel
anything? Did you put your hands on it so you felt them expand?
No, you could definitely see them expand. I think touching them would have been a bit too far, even though I obviously had my lips probably less than 2 centimeters away from it. But it was, you know, just kind of fascinated just to actually watch it and go, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense actually when you kind of see it and kind of blowing in them, expanding them, they kind of slowly deflate. But yeah, it was quite a visceral experience.
Yeah. Did you pretend they were bagpipes at all and start playing a tune on them?
I felt like I was at a party. I had been asked, you know, when someone can't quite blow up a balloon, not one of the long ones, they're always tricky, but yeah. You know, a small round one, you kind of go, I can't get it. Could you do it? It felt a little bit like that, where you kind of have to give it a bit of a, oh, you've got to get it over that first initial hump, and then you're okay. Then it expands. So, yeah. So,
imagine if you'd really, really blown it, like really, really blown it? And they just flown off across the room, like just flew at someone. The poor girl, maybe, who just had a bandage on her foot from where she's pierced. Oh, like,
I'd have loved that. Or done that other thing where he goes around the room and like, no one knows quite where it's going to be. Don't touch the sheep lungs.
That's a mad, I mean, I don't know if they do that in biology lessons anymore. It's been a long time since I was in a biology lesson, so I'm not sure.
Cannot.
But that feels unusual.
Yes. Again, country schools. You know, there was a readily available crop of sheep's lungs at certain points of the year.
You country folk are hardier than us city mice, aren't you? They're just used to that kind of business.
Used to the gristle. What can I say?
Yeah, and it's, you know, and if you're not getting your tea, and you're certainly not getting your biology lesson.
Absolutely, you get out there in that pond.
So I think you've mentioned it already, but I just have to check here. What's the opening scene to Tadpole going to be? Is it going to be like you suggested earlier? Is it going to be that kind of natural history footage of Spawn and Tadpole? You know, that kind of, quite often you have that in films, don't you? Where they kind of have those clips of nature. Is that what the opening scene to Tadpole will be? Or would you go in another direction?
I've gone in another direction, which I think will kind of dovetail into the sort of movie that I'm hoping to kind of make. So in my head, and this was an incident that happened. It's a real incident, although, you know, I've been a bit sort of fancy with it, but it's a real incident that happened in Margate about 1982. And so it's a pivotal year for me. It was on a beach. So basically, this is what I have for the opening scene. So it's on a beach, Margate, picture it, if you will, about 1982.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And it's hot. So it's very unusual for Margate, but on this day it's hot. It's packed. It's very busy. Very close, and we see a Punch and Judy theater in amongst all of this, kind of that kind of very deep red of that Punch and Judy. And then we see an audience of kids just kind of watching it, and then over the top of this we see two parents being very frantic trying to find their kid, calling the name. You can just kind of see them being quite frantic, but all you see is just bodies and people and faces. So it's very reminiscent of the way Jonathan Demme shot. There's a sequence in Silence of the Lambs where Jonathan Demme shoots Clarice at the training school. And when she kind of comes in and all the faces of the men kind of just stare at her as if she's kind of looking up, as if they're saying, you shouldn't be here. Why are you doing here? So it's got an element of that onto it. And then we see then the Punch and Judy show. Cuts back to the kids, and now there's only one kid. There's one kid in the middle. There's still the noise of the beach, but it's completely empty, and there's one kid. And it cuts back to the Punch and Judy, and there's nothing else around it. There's just a Punch and Judy theater on the beach. And then from one corner comes a life-size Punch, creeping out from one side, and out of the other side, a life-size Judy.
Oh, no.
And then they slowly kind of creep out. Still, there's just like sound of wind and people and noise and things like that. they slowly creep out and in into the lens, kind of stick their faces into the lens. It's kind of watching them and wondering what's happening. And then it'll snap to black and say tadpole. that's my opening.
This is an audio program. Tim there was leaning in with his hands raised in the manner of a very creepy Punch and Judy. That was pretty spooky. That's a real event.
Yeah, all of it. I haven't embellished it at all. No, the real event is that I did get lost on a beach in Margate in 1982. On this particular day, I remember hearing there was like a newspaper seller. And I said to my dad, oh, do you want a newspaper? And I thought it was being very adult. In going not very far, like it was only like a couple of hundred feet or something like that, not far at all, to the edge of the where the street was, and it kind of dropped down to the beach, and giving the guy the 20p for the newspaper as it was then, but then turning around and going, I have absolutely no idea where I am. There were so many people, I just had no idea. And then I remember kind of slowly beginning to kind of walk back and think, I don't know where I am. Like, I literally don't know where I am. And then there was this Punch and Judy going on. So I thought, well, I have no idea where I am, but I may as well just go there. I may as well just go and sit and watch this Punch and Judy show, because otherwise I'm just going to get panicked. And it'll give me kind of time. And if I stay in one place, then maybe that'll help. And I just remember kind of sitting and watching this Punch and Judy show. And I guess for kind of like an opening sequence, if you've got to kind of read into it, is that element of being distanced from your parents, from safety. Yeah. And then the safety then being what you then go on to do. You then find safety in something artistic. That's an anchor where you kind of think, well, I'm safe here, even though there are elements within it that may be a bit unsavory.
Yeah. So how long were you missing for? How long were you?
I have no idea. It was the length of a Punch and Judy show. So maybe what's that? 20 minutes? Then like enough to make you vomit in your hands as a parent. Enough to kind of start thinking in the back of your head, who's to blame for this? Is it you or is it me?
Were you in any trouble, or was it all resolved quite quickly?
It had gone through trouble. You know, when you're kind of, it's annoying. Now there's real, no, it's serious. There's trouble. Then it's relief. So I hit the relief point. Obviously, the questions were after that of going, well, why were you sitting at a Punch and Judy show instead of trying to find us? Oh, I was, but I thought this would be the best thing. So, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's quite a present state of mind to be in as a child, to think, well, okay, if I just stay in this one place, which also happens to be providing some entertainment for me, and I'm not adverse to that, but to be fixed in one place, that's quite smart. It's quite clever to think.
I thought so too. I mean, it was probably, you know, by more mistake than design. But I thought, you know, this is a good thing. And also, you know, it would kind of thin out a bit as well, because it was so busy. Everyone was kind of packed in one place. You kind of think, well, I'm sure they'll find me. I'm sure that my parents will work out that the chances are I might go here than just kind of wander around all over the place.
And what happens now if you see a Punch and Judy show? Do you instantly regress to that moment? Are you terrified of them? Can you not look at them?
They are slightly terrifying. I actually went to a Punch and Judy show. One of my kids' friends had a birthday and they had a Punch and Judy guy. And you kind of look at it now and go, well, for all the, you know, the obvious things, you go, Jesus, my God, it's really violent. Sexist and like could be racist. I mean, it's all of the things you kind of go, oh, why? Why would you do and put your kids in front of these things? Like all the other parents, including me, were looking around going, this wasn't what I remembered. This wasn't what I remember. Like that scene in Frasier, you know, where they love the actor, the Derek Jacobi. They go, oh, he's the greatest actor in the world. I can't believe he hasn't worked for so many years. We should get him in. And then you see him and he's terrible. It was that kind of thing going, wow, okay, this is quite. And the guy that was doing it was very old and crotchety and almost like didn't like kids. one of those kind of things. So yeah, it puts the heebie-jeebies up me.
Yeah, I think they are terrifying. I saw one recently by chance, and it's the raspy voices. There's and like the that kind of fixed malevolence, particularly on Punch's face. There's that kind of real, again, in folk horror kind of vibe about that character. And the thought of giant ones as well, that's really disturbing. Yeah. That's properly disturbing.
Absolutely. Especially if you kind of, because you know the kind of like bursts of anger and violence that come from that character.
Yes.
That would then transpose into something life-size. You kind of think, oh, that could be quite nasty.
A giant punch with a massive stick. And he doesn't use a squeaky voice, just leans into you. That's the way to do it. Just like really kind of like...
That's terrifying. I mean, that honestly, that is terrifying.
Sweet dreams, everyone. I have to, just a question there. Have you ever lost your children? Have they ever wandered off and you've...
One did. We're talking minutes that we'd just lost sight of. And again, it was at a kid's party. It's like a disco. And they had sort of flashing lights. Again, it felt very filmic in the sense of going, okay, there she is. I can see her. Someone says hello. You go, oh, hi, how are you? Looking the other way, look back, gone. And she's tiny, and she was tiny at the time. And so you're thinking, well, where? I can't, my brain can't work out because there's that kind of strobe flash where you think,
oh no,
I don't quite understand where things are in relation to anything else. So I cannot work out where she could possibly go. My logical brain says this way, but we're talking about a five-year-old. That doesn't come into play. You have to then try and work out. I was a five-year-old. Where would I go? And just as we were kind of working out, and that sweat begins to kind of go, oh God, oh my God, this is it, nightmare. Another parent said, oh, I found her outside. Oh God. And she'd not gone the way that you would naturally go. She decided that, oh, I'll just go out this open door.
Straight out of
this open door, out into the car park.
Yeah.
To just kind of, you know, have a wander. I think, oh my God. So yeah, that was the longest 2 minutes of my entire life. I feel those minutes have aged me and grayed me more than any other time in my entire life.
Well, I mean, it's a crackerjack opening scene because it is terrifying and visual and it really transports you to kind of a disrupted state of mind, a slightly unbalanced, you know, you're kind of off kilter. So yeah. I have to ask Tim, who's going to play Tim Downey in Tadpole?
Well, I was thinking about this and it's really tricky. You know, like I'd love someone like Daniel Day-Lewis, but that's just too much. That's too much, you know, and he's probably busy. I think someone like Will Poulter would be really, really good.
Yes,
loved him in so many things that he has done. And he's funny. There's a little bit of kind of weird sort of darker edge to it as well. I think he'd be great. I think he'd be really good. I think he'd bring something really interesting to it. I really like Midsommar. I thought he was really, really good in that. That kind of slightly kind of funny, geeky, kind of bumbly sort of character. He was in War Machine, where he's played someone very, very different.
But even you were in War Machine.
Sorry, I was in War Machine. I was in War Machine as well. Yes, and I remember seeing him in that and thinking, oh yeah, you're really good. You're really, really good. And he's playing an American. And he's like, that's really good. But I think the main one is like Son of Rambo, which was, I think, was his first film. Yeah. And it was just brilliant. And you kind of think, yeah, it's that kind of childhood evocation that I think you'd be really, really good at.
He's an example of a British young British actor who is making these really interesting films and also kind of doing like the Maze Runner as well. These kind of big the YA dystopian franchise pieces as well. Mm. Is that the key? Do you think to a long career, to kind of keeping a career interesting, being able to flip between the two as opposed to getting, I don't know, I say trapped in any one, but I mean, it's quite hard to move between those two often, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. But I think it's the absolute key to kind of keeping it interesting, keeping it fresh and keeping sort of, you know, you engaged by doing all the different things. Because as an actor, you would set out and kind of think, well, I would love to do something like this and I'd love to do something like this. And if I get to do this, that would be amazing. And I think once you begin to kind of tick off certain things, it then would be really nice to do like a massive budget, you know, explosions and things like that, where you're just kind of running around being heroic, but then also doing something like, you know, The Lives of Others, where it's all, you know, an extraordinary drama, and then doing something funny like Anchorman or something like that. You know, how brilliant to be able to kind of do as many of those different things and play as many different kind of versions of yourself as you possibly can. You know, that's for me sort of like the ultimate dream.
So when you were in War Machine with Will Poulter, did you share any set time together? Did you work alongside him?
No, my bits weren't with him, but we would sit backstage. When I say backstage, I mean around the tank that they had. And it was, it was a bizarre thing because there was a lot of young actors being army guys, and I think they'd been put in, like, together in like a boot camp.
Oh man,
so they were quite, I guess, blokey and boy-y together because they've been together for so long. Plus, they've been trained so that there's a certain element that you can't really get. You have to kind of be drilled to kind of, you know, be a soldier and be convincing. But they were all very lovely. It was all very nice. And just very strange to kind of sit around a tank and watch Chinook helicopters fly around the mountains, land, and all these soldiers run out, and thinking, God, this is fun, and no one gets killed. This is great.
What sort of soldier do you make?
My military presence would probably be like Corporal Klinger. MASH. I would definitely think that would be me dressing up, trying to get out of it in any way I possibly could.
Would you veer into Yossarian territory, or would you just stick with the kind of box of dress up and some of the costume changes?
I'd stick with the costume changes. I think that's a nice, safe element. It wrong-foots people. And I think consistency, again, you've just got to be consistent with it, which may require spending some money on some good pearls. But I'm willing to do that to get out of a war situation.
We've got the lead, Will Poulter. Mm-hmm. We've got the opening scene. We know it's Tadpole. But what genre would Tadpole be, Tim? And what kind of budget are we looking at here? I mean, it's Will Poulter. So, I mean, we've just... You know, it could be a huge budget film. It could be an indie budget film. So what were you thinking, genre and budget?
I was thinking it's going to be probably low budget indie. There's
nice.
A certain aesthetic, which I like with that. I think it would be slightly absurdist. It would have a lot of elements of magical realism in it. And I think it would be, as I've put a little kind of tagline here, is it would have all the hilarity of being John Malkovich and all the existential angst of Naked Gun. that's my tag. So I think it would play between what's real, what isn't real, flights of fancy, that elements of magical realism. There's got a South American elements of magical realism, and sort of play that, because as an actor, you are constantly kind of in the world of make believe. Your job is to make things up and make them real, and so you do kind of live in this kind of fantasy as well as the reality of things. You're constantly shifting between almost realities. So I think that element of magical realism would be great. And just a lot of fun.
You mentioned being John Malkovich and an Naked Gun there, two fairly influential films in differing ways. Mm-hmm. What is it about those two films that kind of drew you to use them as markers?
I think with Naked Gun, it was one of the comedies I was allowed to watch that was a bit more modern as a kind of young kid. And it was just the kind of rapid fire gags, which I just really loved. Going, they must have put so much effort into this. Just do kind of gag after gag after gag after gag, little bits, you know, don't call me Shirley. I know that's Airplane, but it's all those kind of, all those kind of things. And with the being John Malkovich, it was something that was so almost European in its sensibility, with an American sort of budget to it. Like, you know, the lift stopping halfway and having to open it up and going on to floor eight and a half. And just the kind of exploration of that idea of self and the oddness of it. And his use of puppets I really loved as well, which goes back to that earlier bit as well. I really enjoyed. So I think all of that kind of comes into play.
Have you gone back to Malkovich recently? Have you gone back to being John Malkovich recently? I've not watched it for a long time.
No, I'm the same. Probably about 7 years or something like that. So it's been quite a while. But I remember watching it and I just absolutely loving it. And then watching other ones of his, like adaptation of those Charlie Kaufman's, which again, I thought was just, you know, a brilliant piece of writing. And that whole idea about not having a voiceover, but then they have a voiceover. Brilliant. was just great. So yeah, and playing with the form. I'm not saying this film is going to be anywhere near that, but it's certainly going to try. It's going to try.
I just want to see a tadpole crawl into Malkovich's head, or Malkovich crawling into a tadpole's head. That's all I ask from Tadpole, Tim.
Honestly.
And in Naked Gun, you said it's about watching, about the rapid fire gags and the time that goes into that as well. You've worked in a lot of comedy. Do you think comedy is taken for granted, particularly when it seems that easy? And yet, as someone who works in this sort of field, you know, you appreciate the length of time it must have taken to craft that number of jokes and for that all then to hang together in a vaguely coherent narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a tough thing to do, comedy, to be funny, because it's so subjective and it's so personal that some people will find it hilarious, some people just go, no, I didn't like it at all. And they will have that immediate reaction. It's the same with horror. If something doesn't strike you as frightening or doesn't get you where it needs to get you, you'll kind of write it off a bit, which you don't get with things that are serious dramas, because you will give them a bit more time. You will allow them to develop. You allow the characters to come out and kind of go, okay, well, let's see where this is going. It has a bit more time to kind of get under the skin. But comedy certainly has that thing of, okay, I haven't laughed in the first 5 minutes, let's turn it over, which is just so, so harsh, because it takes such a long time to craft, to find the right gag. And there are so many elements that come into play, performance as well as camera angle, as well as cost, as there's so many bits that go into making it. So I think it's got to be much more highly revered than it is. And it's an important thing. You know, we have satire through comedy, and that's the most important thing, I think, of all, is being able to hold people in authority to account. And I think that's, you know, an incredibly important thing. And I think if we lose that or ridicule that or try to get rid of that, then we are in a sorry state as a society.
Because Upstart Crow, it was one of these rare example of a TV show transferring to the stage, which doesn't happen very often. I know only Fools and Horses is a musical, but that's obviously taken years and years. But Upstart Crow transferred, I mean, while it's still airing on the television, pretty much.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the pandemic hit, didn't it? And that kind of scuppered things a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. But actually, you know, the very nature of Upstart Crow was that sense of play, of it being a play, of it being within that proscenium arch. So for that, all TV shows, when you're doing a TV show about Shakespeare and about writing plays, the transition to it being a play should be one that most people will go, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yep, that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, no, it's very sad that the pandemic ended the plans of that. So I don't know if they're going to revive it or not, but, you know, we shall see.
And what are you like when you're filming comedy? Are you good at staying in character, staying straight while you're acting with some extremely funny people? You know, you play Danny Bear in Toast. Mm. You sit in the room telling Stephen Toast what to do.
Yeah.
What are those scenes like to film?
Some of them are the most horrendous, and I mean horrendous in a loving way, in the sense that they are the hardest scenes to do and to keep that kind of po-faced cynical edge, because some of the things are just so ridiculous and so funny that it kind of sends you a bit crazy, because you're stuck in a totally dark, windowless room for hours on end, having to face that. And you just think, this is just hard. And you have to kind of just have a moment just trying to kind of break away from it, because it is so funny. I mean, that's a joy of a job to do. Yeah, and to be, you know, to have that as a problem at work. I just laugh too much. you know, roll on, may they be all the problems.
Was there a time you had to kind of, you say literally have to have a break because you couldn't, you had to compose yourself because things had gotten to that slightly hysterical?
Yeah, yeah. There's one in particular, which was the dubbing the German porn scene, because to kind of build Matt and Harry up to kind of like that sort of climactic scent, that scene, we had to do it a lot. Like, we did it a lot, and they had to get closer and closer and closer to really get it. So at the end, they were probably no more than like 3 inches apart, really kind of really keeping eye contact, and it went on and on and on, and it was impossible to just go, I can't keep watching this. I cannot do it. I have to just give me a moment, because it's too funny.
The one that always sticks with me is when he's doing the sort of the audio commands for the nuclear submarine. The PA system announcements on the nuclear submarine.
I have nuclear weapons.
Just the the very thought of it being like the tube, like it just is just a very, it's just a brilliant, the conceit in itself is just very funny. And they're not saying it in the right way. Like there's no easy way to say fire the nuclear weapons, unleash Armageddon. Like what, how, I'm sorry, am I doing it in a kind of, am I being too funny? Am I being too light? Am I being too severe? Am I saying this in too severe a way? Keep it light, guys.
Exactly. We all know what's going to happen. Let's at least put it on a level.
So it's the lo-fi, low-budget, absurdist, magical, realist film. So which parts of your life would have to be in this absurdist, magical, realist film? And why? And would we continue to see giant punts and Judy figures during the film? Would they keep popping up again?
I definitely think there'd be moments of that. There'd be rooms that are far too small. Things you'd have to there'd definitely be elements of that. There'd be in the village I grew up, there was a haunted house. Would definitely have that, where there was it was terrifying. Like I remember at one evening in particular, I used to go for walks with my dad around our village, you know, just to kind of get out, basically. And I remember one evening there were a load of police cars parked outside this house, and there were guys led out who were wearing hoods as they were being led out and put in the car, and then the car's driving. You kind of go, wow, what's going on in that house? That's really, really weird. This abandoned house in the, and it obviously is a bit like Edward Scissorhands. It was right in the middle of our village, old abandoned house with this like, kind of single track that linked these two sort of mainish roads. And so as kids, you would dare yourselves to go into the house, go in, go up the stairs, and then there'd be like a long corridor that you'd have to walk down. And there was like old kind of bits of jars and things like that. And the idea was you used to grab a jar and then make your way out. And there were lots of other kind of weird signs and symbols that were kind of written in the downstairs rooms. which I remember seeing and things like that. So that would definitely make an appearance.
Wow.
Because that was a very weird sort of period and sort of time.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, really exciting. I still remember it. It still thrills me to think about it. I would also put in things like my mother, because she was a huge, and still is a huge champion of mine. And I think in this life, you really do need someone who's going to be your champion. You need someone to kind of have your back every once in a while and kind of go, no, you keep doing it. Keep going, keep doing what you want to do. So I would definitely have that in. I'd have elements of drama school, because just the oddness of drama school, there's certain things, you know, when you were asked to evolve from a jellyfish into a cat. I don't know how that works with Chekhov, but apparently it does. So you definitely have those elements. And then things, you know, sort of coming up to date, have things like being a dad and how much that changes things, how much that changes the focus and how, and the sort of importance you put upon your work and how the importance of your work changes, which I've found fascinating and extraordinary, just how the kind of shift of importance of your work moves. Like, you know, you start off with it doing it for you and you kind of end with, not end, but you kind of then progress into doing it for them. And that shift is really quite an extraordinary one. It becomes very your work becomes selfless. You're doing it for them now. You're doing it so that they can have everything they want, rather than saying, I'm doing this for everything I want, you know.
How do you think becoming a dad has changed you as an actor? And, you know, in terms of, to talk about the nature of the work that that selflessness, but in terms of performance and how you read scripts and how you play characters, has becoming a parent changed you in that respect? Has it changed your style of acting or your performances?
I think it's certainly given it more depth, I guess, because you understand a whole other side of life that you didn't until that moment have any insight into. I think it's made me more selfish and made me sort of more open to things. It's certainly made me more patient. One thing you definitely learn with kids is patience. I thought I was a patient, kind of calm kind of guy. I was not. I was absolutely not. Now you kind of learn to accept change, because having kids is all about change. Your order of things, they're just going to just shit all over. They don't care about your order of things. They don't care when you want to do things. Doesn't matter. So you have to kind of get into that zen state of just accepting change that is a part of life. And if you embrace it, then it gives back and all those kind of things. So that has been an enormous eye-opener, an enormous, like, sort of personal growth, like the likes of which I've not known before. But that's certainly, yeah, given me a whole new insight into, you know, just the world around, which I think hopefully can only kind of enrich what you do.
Do they ever ask you to be in particular shows or films? Do they ever say, can you be in this or can you be in that?
No, they love the fact that I'm in Paddington because their friends tell them your dad's in Paddington, which they love. I think they've spent their entire lives with, you know, dad in the kitchen talking to himself. What are you doing? Oh, I'm running lines. I'm doing, oh, right. Okay. So they're very much kind of, you know, aware that, oh, okay, you're doing this. Now you're shouting in the kitchen. There's nobody there. You're just talking to yourself yet again, or you're talking to the kettle or to something, you know, those kind of things. So they're very used to it. So they see it as just like a job, whereas their friends see it as like, oh my word, you know, you found Paddington. That's amazing. That's incredible. Yeah, they love it. They do love it. They're getting to kind of understand a bit more about what it is because they're starting to do school plays, just little bits and pieces. So they have to learn lines. So they get very excited because they kind of know, oh, okay, you do it like this. And they tell their friend, oh yeah, you do it like this because my dad does it like this. It's really lovely.
Have you passed on any tips? Do they come to you for advice or do you let them work out their own method? And do your children go method?
Children go very method. They, they're very focused. They mess around, which I absolutely say, keep doing that. So very, very sort of unparenty of going, yeah, mess around more. Mess around as much as you possibly can, because that's the joy in it. Find the joy in it, which is probably the antithesis of what you say in every other walk of life. Then sit down, behave, don't make a noise. There's a lot of that. But yeah, I think it's very, very different, you know, having a dad, having a parent who's an actor, you know, because all their friends' parents do so many other different things. Much like when I grew up, my dad and my parents just did, you know, normal jobs. They were just, you know, they went out, they went to work and they came home. Whereas doing something like this is different, you know, and it is just it's an odd job. It's a very odd thing to do as a profession. And then to kind of put a child in that, to kind of go, what does your dad do? He plays dress up. That's what your dad does. He just dresses up. Yeah, he dresses up. He goes away and dresses up and does a silly voice and then comes home. And, you know.
But when your kids' mouths ask you to play sometimes, they say, oh, can we play, you know, this game? You can never say no, can you? Because that's what you do for a living and they know you're good at what you do, or that's what you...
But having said that, you know that old saying about if you go around a painter and decorator's house, it's terrible. Why I do this day in, day out. I have the same problem with my wife with clothes shopping. Why don't you try these clothes on? I don't want to, because I do it all the time. I'm constantly, try this on, try that on, put this on, put that on. And so there is a definite element of especially when they have friends over, they go, oh, your dad can do this. No, I don't want to. I don't want to do it. But it's just, you know, us little family. Then yeah, great. But
do you make your kids' friends call your agent to find out like what they charge, like what they ask in fee wise?
My availability, because I might not be there. I might be out doing anything.
I know you mentioned your mum there about how supportive she's been during your career. She's a champion, you said. How that important it is to have someone like that. Is that because when you start out as an actor? And even now, obviously, as an actor, you're a freelancer. You work from job to job, and at the start, it's quite tough, right, to get a gig. Yeah. What did your mum do that was so supportive? Would she always come to your things? Would she always help with read-throughs? What would she do?
She was just there, and we knew, you know, growing up, we knew nothing about this world at all. It was the furthest thing away from our sort of village life that you could really think of doing, really, and. You just need someone there that's going to kind of help you by also learning it. Like my mother had no idea what things were. So she made it her business to kind of, well, okay, well then I'll learn about it. I'll just kind of find someone to talk to, or I'll read the stage newspaper. You know, I will educate myself and learn as to how you can achieve that, or the routes you should go. And also putting those sort of safeguardings in place so that what you then go on to do, you're going to be safe doing. Which was absolutely vital. I think, you know, because if I was just left to my own devices, there's no way I would have had any idea where to go, what to do. God only knows what would have happened. So you do, yeah, that was totally, totally invaluable and an extraordinary sort of selfless thing to do, just purely to do it, to go, no, you want to do this? Okay. Well, then let's do it. You better be good.
Would you be supportive of your kids going into acting? Would you feel like you had a obviously, because you've got a background now, all this experience, would you be supportive of them pursuing a career in the industry?
I would just want them to do anything that makes them happy. Just because you think, after what we've been through in the last year and a half, you realize that time is very, very fleeting. Like, you know, we were talking about earlier about how quick a year can go and how we've kind of, most people kind of write that year off because nothing happened. Everything happened, yet nothing happened. And it's this kind of empty block of hollow time. So I think, you know, just do what you can to make yourself happy and just try and enjoy it as much as you can, because it is fleeting. Like, you know, look at my kids now and you kind of think, my God, you know, time just disappears. Like in the short space of time, you've learned to walk, talk. You can now dress yourself. You can now do so many things in such a short space of time. And yet, you know, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast. You know, it's that kind of, it's strange. But yeah, no, I just want them to do whatever they want. If they wanted to do it, then great, then do it. Try it. Try everything.
So we know what would be in the film, Tim. We know what you want in Tadpole. But what are the moments from your life that you would have on the cutting room floor? Are those years as a telemarketer, are they on the cutting room floor?
No, some of those would have to remain. A lot of that would have to go. The main thing I would want to cut out is all the waiting. There is a lot. There's an old actor saying, the acting is free. They pay me for the waiting, because you do a lot of it. And I think you've got to take out all of that. And also just the kind of early waiting as a young actor of kind of waiting by the phone or waiting by the email or doing all these kind of things. You would want to lose all of that, little elements of it, to give you an idea about what it's really like. But yeah, the majority of the waiting you would definitely want to get rid of.
Does drama school or anyone that ever taught you, did they kind of give you any advice or tips on how to deal with the waiting, or even any warning of the waiting?
No, not at all. They just kind of, they teach you the sort of rudiments of acting, the styles of acting, and all the kind of, you know, technical sides of things. But just kind of things you kind of think, well, I really doubt this would have been really useful to know, is just kind of things like, you know, on set, hang your costume up. Don't be just sort of like, oh, I'm just going to throw that on the floor. Hang your costume up. Be respectful of things. Be on time. Don't expel all your energy, you know, by trying to be the funny guy at like 6 o'clock in the morning to all the makeup and wardrobe. Don't do that, because by the time you come to your scene at 11 or 12 or 1 or 2, you're going to be exhausted. And you'll have to dredge it up. All your good stuff is given over. But all those practical advices, you think, you know, that would have been really useful to know. You know, it's really useful to know all the other bits and pieces, but just the rudiments, some rudimentary bookkeeping would be actually quite useful, because, you know, you live so much of your time is like feast or famine. We have money, let's spend it. We have no money, don't spend it. So something like that would have been, you know, useful, you know.
Now you've mentioned a few influences already on Tadpole, but I'm wondering if there are any other that you've considered that would have a part to play in the making of Tadpole, influences from film or TV or literature or theatre or comics.
There's probably a lot, probably far too many for me to kind of drag through, but I will do my best to kind of truncate it. So definite sort of influences would be films such as Harold and Maude.
Oh, yeah.
Which I loved. Again, it touches on that edge of magical realism. Time Bandits.
Oh,
I would love a bit of that in there somewhere, or that kind of fun, that kind of playfulness. There's things like The Seventh Seal, which I love, which kind of talks about great, enormous questions, but kind of tells them quite playfully. There's quite a funny section in The Seventh Seal. Everyone kind of assumes it's all about death on the beach and playing chess, which it is. But there's a very funny sort of section as well, as they're kind of like bounding around the countryside with this troop of traveling players with the Black Death all around. Yeah, it's great. It's an extraordinary piece. Buster Keaton.
Oh,
anything by Buster Keaton, I think would be a great influence. There's a film by Peter Jackson, one of his early films called Beautiful Creatures with Kate Winslet, which again touches on this idea of magical realism. He kind of draws on his early work as a horror film director and brings out certain elements. There's two schoolgirls.
Is it Heavenly Creatures?
Heavenly Creatures, you're right. Beautiful Creatures is
another, but
Heavenly Creatures. Yeah. Yeah, and that they have elements of this magical realism and things like that, which I really, again, really loved. And then if I start going on, as my wife would say, onto my sort of more eclectic films, there's a great film by a French director called Patrice Lecomte called The Girl on the Bridge, ooh, which is this great idea of these kind of two, she's a knife thrower's assistant. Oh. Daniel Arthaud is a knife thrower, and they meet, and she's on a bridge contemplating suicide, and he meets her on a bridge and says, will you work for me? If you have this wish that you want to, why don't you work for me as a knife thrower's assistant? And they begin this kind of very extraordinary love affair over kind of time and distance, where someone will move something and then it will move wherever that other person is. And it's the kind of overlapping of film that is beautifully done, and that they can't really live without each other, but they are, but they have to be apart, but their lives mirror separately. It's a beautiful film.
And what's that called? The Girl on the Bridge?
Girl on the Bridge.
Is it the most French film ever made? By the sounds of things, it is. Oh, a knife thrower assistant in a metaphysical love.
Yeah. I mean, what's not to love? I mean, already I'm getting tingles. It's already brilliant. I love it. I love it already. And there's a brilliant film by a Japanese director called Bita Kashi. Dolls, which is sensational. Again, it's that kind of like a love story, but it's told through the medium, again, puppets again. The opening, those kind of nori puppets, those Japanese puppets, and then how they mirror our lead characters. And it's the way they kind of, he does edits that don't, and the sound doesn't change. So the scene sound, it covers like four or five different scenes, but this kind of Japanese music covers over their puppets, over the people being just walking around on their daily lives, then back to the kind of puppets. Really beautifully done. Really beautifully done. In fact, a lot of his films would be a big influence on me. Hannah B is another one, which is, again, amazing.
What's the one when they're on the beach and it's like it was a 90s one. I'm trying to think, they're on the beach and they're firing fireworks at each other. I think these gangsters have kind of gone to a beach somewhere to lay low. And it was a 90s one. I can't remember the name of it, but I really enjoyed that one when I saw it. Mm. And what a review that was, eh?
What but,
There was a lot of puppets. You like a puppet, don't you?
I do like a puppet. It's quite strange, actually. I hadn't really realised how much I love a puppet in film until I literally had this chat. It's literally revelatory to me whilst this is happening. Going, oh my God, I really do like puppets in films. That's quite something.
Can you do puppetry?
I can, because I was working in Prague many years ago, and obviously that's like the centre of puppetry. And I was a very big fan, and still am, a big fan of Jan Schwanmeier, who does a lot of animated Prague, Czech animations. He did a film called Alice, which is extraordinary. But again, they're all kind of stop motion animation. And I remember going to a puppet shop in Prague and buying a load of puppets, which was great, which I still have, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because they're all archetypes. There's a lot of archetypes in Czech puppetry. So you will have a figure called the conductor, who is like the narrator, almost like a kind of, almost like a death figure, but is narrating whatever the story may be. And then you'll have like demons as well as mortals and all sorts of little things, but it's quite folk based. Like there's a lot of stories about the demon of the Vltava, and that's the river that runs through Prague. And then you've got the stories of like Rabbi Loh and the birth of the golem and things like that. So it's very sort of folkloric in its retelling. But I love the medium of puppetry.
Have you put the puppets in a room and then walked out and then come back later and they've moved?
If that happened, I would literally have to lock that door and move house. There's nothing else for it. We're selling the house. Why? Puppets have moved. Fair enough, they'd say. Fair enough.
That's a no then, but does it keep, that would keep me awake at night.
Oh, it's just horrendous. Whenever I even hear a noise like, anywhere, it could be absolutely anything, that I immediately think monsters or ghosts. that's my go-to. Not there's a cat outside or something like that, or whatever it may be. It's a ghost or a monster without a doubt. Oh, something's dropped in the kitchen. It's haunted. I know we've been here for nearly 14 years and we would have noticed something now, but I think this house is now haunted.
I often have that similar reaction to you. I remember not too long ago, I caught an aroma. I was like, oh, that's a strange aroma. Where's that come from? And it's an old property here. So I think, okay, is that some kind of ghost, you know, some kind of spirit of some woman from years ago and her perfume. And then I just found out someone had lit a candle. But but basically, I immediately thought, oh my God, it's like those stories you read about, you know, that they, oh, they, before you see her, you will smell her fragrance and that kind of thing. And like all of a sudden this woman was going to sort of apparate in front of me. No, it's just some candle got lit and I wasn't aware.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's all right, actually. Yeah.
It's all right. It's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, better than being tormented by a demonic presence from hell, but I mean, it's no warm cinnamon lunch. Whatever. Absolutely. The one that we had last time.
How much was it? Oh no, I'd rather have the demon. Thank you very much.
A candle. Yes. Well, I mean, I love the hefty array of influences, and I love the fact that so many of them already sort of map into Tadpole and the early stages of Tadpole that you mentioned. But what about the critics, Tim? If they love it or hate it, how would that affect you and your next project? If they love it or they hate it, would that affect you and your next project?
I don't think it would. I'd love it, obviously, if people loved it, but I don't. It would be the type of project that you would do to either exorcise things or just to kind of have a sense of completion. And I think it'd be the type of project that I would just want to have a lot of fun with. This is fun, and I'd want everybody on it to kind of have fun. It would be absurdist, and you would have, you know, probably serious moments and things like that. But it's almost like, you know, like Malkovich and like some of these other films, you know, it's kind of allegorical, almost like a folk tale. And that would be the kind of approach that I would like to take with it, that it's, you know, fantastical and have strange sort of strange moments. It's like it would be something by Terry Gilliam when he kind of goes off on his own sort of little flight of fancy and then kind of then brings it back to a reality.
Do you ever pay much attention to what the critics say, whether it's your work or anyone else's?
No, not really. No, I don't. I mean, again, if they are hugely praiseworthy, then yes, of course. but if they're not, then I'd rather not know. I mean, it's so difficult though, because obviously with critics, either the work has already been done and it's in the can and it's already edited and tied together in a little bow, and you kind of go, well, I can't do anything about it. So I could take that on board, but I can't do anything about it. Or, which I think must be the worst one, is where you get a bad review and you're in a play and you've just started and you know you've then got 3 months of this. That must be horrendous. So I think all in all, you know, ignore them. It's a creative thing. Not everybody's going to like it. Not everybody likes The Shining, bizarrely enough. Not everybody likes The Godfather, oddly enough. But, you know, that doesn't diminish, you know, the work. There are some, you know, films that people go, God, that's awful. How on earth do you like that? But, I like it. You know, I think that's a really good piece of work. And you just got to keep reminding yourself that, you know, that's what art is. It's subjective. And if it's there and it poses questions, I'd rather have someone hate something and love something than just kind of go,
yeah.
See that? Yeah, right. That would be heartbreaking, because that means you've done nothing. You haven't even provoked no reaction whatsoever. You know, it's like an afternoon of your movie. It was like an afternoon at B&Q. No emotion whatsoever.
Oh, that would be... Have you ever had that feeling?
No. Well, luckily, no. And chances are it probably has happened, but I've completely blocked it out. That's just not even on the radar anymore. Yeah, that would be the worst. That would be the worst.
So Tadpole, Tim, is in the can. It's the premiere. Where's the premiere taking place? And who's invited? Is it going to be at B&Q? Are you going to hire out a B&Q and screen it at B&Q? Or are you thinking somewhere else?
Right by the drain pipes and switches in the local B&Q. I would probably have to have two sort of premieres, if I could, if that's possible. Yeah. Simultaneous ones.
It's your film, it's your money. You do
it. My money, I do what I want. So I would probably have it at a local haunted house, which I think would be amazing.
Yes! Yes!
Yeah. I think that would be great. I think, again, it would be in keeping, much like when we met the execs at the beginning, just the slightly wrong foot people. He's going to go, oh, okay, this house is, oh, yeah, it's quite haunted, that kind of thing. I think that would be great. And also, I would want one in West London, because it's my adopted home and I love it. And I feel I would want to do something there to be representative of, you know, of somewhere where I feel is my home.
Yeah. That's, I mean, is there a haunted house you have in mind?
Well, I was actually thinking of the house that was haunted at the time. And worryingly, it is now, people now live there. It's been totally renovated and people actually live there. So I always want to knock on the door at some point and go, do you remember? You don't know this, but in the early 80s, there was an incident, which I think they'll be really pleased with.
You'd be that guy from horror films who always knocks on the door and says, you've got to leave. There are etchings on the skirting boards.
Yeah.
Don't paint over them. You'll be damned if, you know what I mean? Like, there's always that
absolutely. You'll be the Mr. Halloran character that's sort of like, you got to watch out for this. And then you kind of come back to try and save them and then get horribly hurt. Which would be terrible. Well, I could do it in the most haunted house in London, which is, I think it's called, it's 50 Berkeley Square. It's be the most haunted house in London.
Yes.
You could do it there. Or you could do something that's a bit more sort of wild and abandoned.
Yeah.
That could be quite, that could be quite fun. Or maybe somewhere out in the sticks, out in the country. Yeah. Something like maybe in Aldborough or somewhere like that with a kind of M.R. James connection, kind of hauntiness or things like that. That would be good. If I could keep it in the area where it will kind of be from, then that would be good. So maybe somewhere in Hertfordshire. There's loads of haunted places in Hertfordshire.
Have you seen a ghost?
No, I haven't. But I think that is down to the fact that I would so dearly want to see a ghost that they then get pushed away.
You're saying ghosts are like cats. They know if you don't like them, so they come up to you. And ghosts know that if you want to see them, they're like, I'm not giving the guy the pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. Not you. You're just going to be talking about it and talking about it, and it's just going to get boring. I'm going to diminish my own, you know.
I'm trying to scare you here, man. Why are you clapping?
Stop taking notes. No, I would love to see a ghost. I always kind of go, oh, but that's why I get so sort of like, oh my God, is that a ghost? Almost thrill of it, of like, well, I probably should go and see. You know, I am definitely the one in the horror film that goes, I'll go and see what's going on outside. Don't go. Oh, he's gone. He's gone now. He won't be coming back.
Do you know what they never say, though, in those films? They never have that person who says, I'll go and check at that weird noise. They never say, oh, it could be a ghost. This is amazing. They never kind of get excited and like go out to look. It's always like, oh, it'll be fine. It'll just be, you know, it'll be some badgers or it'll be the wind or it'll be some badgers attacking the wind, but it will never be a ghost. They're never kind of intrigued enough to think it could be something supernatural.
No, and they always seem to kind of go out with all this kind of gung-ho, like, don't worry, Brad, I'll go and check in the garage. And they kind of go out with all kind of bounce, bounce, bounce. And then as soon as they get into the darkness, they stop. They go, well, obviously, you're slightly scared. You should have just said, no, you go. It's frightening out there. It's the middle of the night, and I don't know the area.
I really love the idea of a premiere in a haunted house. That is absolutely amazing. Who's invited to the premieres? Either the haunted house one or the West London one. Who's invited? Who's coming?
I think everybody should be. Everyone. Nice. Come one, come all. That's lovely.
And what about, is there anyone who isn't invited there?
No, I think, everyone.
Everyone
can come. Everyone can come. Bring a dish, bring a bottle, make a night of it.
Make a terrifying night of it.
Absolutely. Why not? Come on, bring everyone. Let's have some fun.
Congratulations on Tadpole, an absurdist, magical, realist folktale starring Will Poulter, featuring Jack and the Beanstalk, Punch and Judy, haunted houses, tiny rooms, dubbed German porn, puppets, and knife throwers. Tim Downey, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very excited and I can't wait to make the sequel.